This is Classic Business with Michael Avery on Classic 1027 in Johannesburg and Fine Music Radio in Cape Town.
Well, it was a case of an apple overnight, not keeping the doctor away, certainly bringing coronavirus fears to the fore. The economic impact of coronavirus grows stronger, particularly after Apple said that it's going to have to change its guidance. Its Frankfurt listed shares dropping by nearly 5%. We saw firms who make chips and components for Apple also dropping in value. In Asia this morning, South Korean President Moon Jae-in said the economy was in an emergency situation. It looks like Japan is going to be heading into a recession soon, and oil has fallen to around $57 a barrel as well, spooking the markets once again. We saw the oil share down just over 500 points, 0.89%, and pretty much red across my screen. From the top 40 resources, industrials, the only one bucking the trend, gold, as it seems a safe haven is back on the cards, up 1.5%. Nessa Nair, portfolio manager at Sasfin Wealth, is in my studio here in Houghton and down in Cape Town at the Fine Music Radio Studios. We welcome Richard Hassan, fund manager at Electus Fund Managers. Nessun, risk on, risk off. The volatility is unsettling.
Yeah, it's been a tough time. I think the world is struggling with dealing with the coronavirus, and the market itself is not quite sure, you know, whether it makes sense to pick up these equities now in anticipation that the Chinese will get ahead of this contagion, or whether to sit on the sidelines. I mean, we have had a very strong results season, especially from the U.S. tech companies, blowout earnings across the board. But that's behind us now. The market is forward-looking. And I think if you examine what lies ahead of us, I think the risks are probably more to the upside right now. And so it's unsurprising that, you know, the impact is going to be felt in Apple, because China is a big market. You know, it's just the irony is that you never normally associate a virus like this with an IT company. You know, it's usually some other virus that IT companies are quite afraid of. But this looks like it can potentially balloon if it's not got under control.
And Richard, unlikely then to see a positive outlook on those tech companies from the semiconductors and the chip makers. I know you look a lot closer to home, Richard. So looking at gold, it's in the third year of a bull run, which is obviously being sustained by these trade concerns and the uncertainty created by coronavirus. I've been trying to get some form of forward guidance from Chris Griffith yesterday during the Amplats results. I spoke to Tembim Kwanazi earlier today during the Kumba results, and I said, yeah, what do you chaps expect the impact of coronavirus to be on trade? And they were shtum. They say it's still too early to tell. It's a bit of a mealy-mouthed response. It does look like this is going to have a material impact.
Good evening, Michael. Yes, it certainly is going to impact some commodities. Certainly if you look at, say, the likes of iron ore, where demand has been influenced by the potential slowdown in China. And the iron ore price is down 10% over the last month on the back of the coronavirus. So it really is up to the individual commodities. As you said earlier, gold with the flight to safety and the risk off has benefited. Gold close to 1600 at about 1580, 1590 today. So you definitely need to look at individual commodities, the demand supply elements for those. Chris Griffiths yesterday would have spoken about Amplats. In terms of the rhodium market and the palladium market, those are still very tight supply markets. So pricing there might hold up, even if there is a small fall off in demand, as opposed to platinum, where there is an excess supply. So even though they come in the same basket and they're all produced together, there's different demand supply dynamics for every commodity, and that's the job of an investor, to try and understand those, and at the margin where there can be those subtle shifts and changes that will impact pricing.
And whether or not we might see a V-shaped recovery, particularly in the iron ore market, and this is important for the Kumba forward-looking guidance, as well as companies like Afrimat, much smaller, which have recently made investments there. To the Kumba results today, though, Nessun, really healthy set of numbers. These attributable free cash flow of 17.1 billion rand, returning an awful lot of money to shareholders. What was the payout ratio? Just above 90%. Just phenomenal numbers.
It's hard to believe that a few years ago it was a 30 rand a share stock. Now it's paying twice that in dividends. A couple of things that I found interesting in today's action. I mean, on Kumba's results, you know, the cost price per ton of iron ore is somewhere between sort of 300 and 350 rand. And they're selling, last year they realized prices of $97 a ton. So you can do the math and realize this is a huge margin business. You know, Chris Griffiths used to be there as well. And he was, you know, he's done it twice now. He's done it at Kumba and he's done it at Amplats, right? So I think a lot of people are keen to see which commodity he gets involved in future. But, I mean, it was really an impressive set of results. Very much a function of iron ore pricing, though. They managed to address some of the operational issues. The production numbers, which they gave us a few weeks ago, were not that impressive. But the Kolomela mine, which is a new mine that's beginning to ramp up now, has got an even lower cost per ton, below 300 rand. So I think this, this could potentially be a huge opportunity for the country, you know, if we can ensure that the iron ore that is produced there gets to the port. I mean, 99% of the iron ore is now exported. So I think it's only a million tons that's consumed locally, and with ArcelorMittal closing down virtually, you know, it's going to be a full export company. It's one of the areas I think we can ramp up. We can grow production in this sort of enterprise and generate, you know, much needed foreign exchange earnings.
The key there, Nesson, though, is to get it efficiently through the ports. There was a derail issue over 12 months ago. Looking through the numbers, though, it does look like the proactive stance taken by Kumba management to engage with Transnet to get a handle on some of those derailments is starting to pay off. But we still pay far too much in demurrage through the ports in our railing and freight costs in South Africa. There's an area there where we can lower those administered prices.
You know, if you look at the two big Transnet lines, you know, the one that runs the Sishen line to Saldanha and the Richards Bay line, we haven't really grown capacity on that in the last 15 years in an environment where, you know, the country could have benefited hugely, you know, by making the right investment into. And, you know, a lot of people talk about these public-private partnerships. Here's an example that where we had an opportunity for it to work and it didn't. The other thing I wanted to mention on the market action today is most of the shares were down. You know, Kumba's produced results like this, and you could argue that a lot of it is priced in. But, you know, the share prices were down today. The rand was weaker. The palladium price is on the heels of $2,500. And yet, you know, the likes of Implats and Amplats were also down today. So it was hard to reconcile, you know, the results and the commodity price movements to you know, what we're seeing in the underlying commodities.
Richard, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so a few years ago, the JSE introduced a rule where if a company expects their earnings to be more than 20% higher or lower than their prior year comparative, then they have to come out with that guidance. So in the case of, say, Kumba, their earnings were up 68%. They'd already guided for that a few weeks ago. So what you see often now with results is actually on the day results are released, unless there's something very different in the underlying quality of the result, the market already knows the earnings. So I think Kumba had guided to 48 to 52 rand. They came out just above 50 rand. That was versus 30 odd rand in the prior year. So the market knew that. So there was no major surprise for them in terms of the underlying mix of earnings. I think the market expected it.
The big question for investors now is what happens at the parent level with Anglo-American PLC being a big shareholder in both Kumba and Amplats, the big dividends, very chunky dividends being paid over the last few days raises the question of whether a sweetened dividend is now possible. Market consensus is around, I think, 106 cents per share. Would it be bigger than that, Nesson?
I think the if you look at what Anglo-American's been doing is they've been buying back shares, and they recently started with acquisitions, right? They're buying a potash company in the UK, I forget the name. And that's going to cost them, what, £400 million. So, you know, I think the expectations of a big dividend for Anglo-American shareholders should probably be tempered. I think Anglo is going to try and preserve some of that cash. What's interesting is Amplats has got no debt, and Kumba is virtually debt-free as well. So, you know, the question is, you know, do you end up buying back shares? Do you intend investing in future projects? What exactly do you do with the surplus money? And it will be a thing that I'm sure gets mentioned at the AGM, you know, these sort of windfall cash flows. A lot of shareholders are going to want to get their hands on it, right? But I don't anticipate that that Anglo is going to change its dividend too much.
Yeah, and you also want a management team to be confident and say, we know exactly how to allocate that capital in the most effective way, rather than just returning it to shareholders, which is sometimes admitting that you've got nothing else really better to do and to offer. Let's just stay right there, chaps. We've got to take a quick break. And when we return, we'll talk about what's happening in the European banking space on the back of that HSBC news today, set to cut 35,000 jobs.
This is Classic Business with Michael Avery on Classic 1027 in Johannesburg and Fine Music Radio in Cape Town.
Welcome back with your view from the market is Nesson Nair and Richard Hassan. Richard, or Nesson actually, let's put this one to you because you do follow the global stocks slightly more closely. HSBC, 35,000 jobs. It wants to reduce its global headcount by 15% to around 200,000 over the next few years. It's been a difficult period for Europe's biggest investment banks. The European banks in particular are facing a lot of headwinds, negative interest rates, there's a technology issue, and for HSBC operating in markets like Hong Kong and its exposure to China doesn't help.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it's a perfect storm, I think, for European banks, and you've mentioned the issues there. The lending businesses can't generate much money because it's difficult to grow your book in a weak Euro land economy. You've got negative interest rates. There's not much margin there. Your peers, you know, themselves are not very strong. You know, the Italian and the peripheral banks, if we can call them that, you know, are not easy to deal with. And of course, you've just had a big failure like Deutsche Bank now, you know, which is closing up a lot of its international businesses. You know, the American banks on the other side of the Atlantic are not. I mean, they're not doing too badly, but they're not doing phenomenally. They're not doing what you would expect them to be able to do in an environment where you've had almost 10 years of a bull market in the U.S. and with the U.S. economy that's, you know, looks like it's getting stronger and stronger. So I think this is probably, and Deutsche Bank as well, is probably should give us an indication that the face of banking is changing. The way banks operate or should operate in the next 10 years is going to change. And those that make the move early on to adapt to the change, to embrace the technology, you know, to accept that, you know, people are not going to necessarily open up a check account and a mortgage account and finance their car through a bank, is to accept that and identify new trends in borrowing and in lending and to adopt these early on. You know, there's all industries are being disrupted with technology, and I think banks probably are one of the ones, because historically they had such fat margins, they are one of the ones that I think that can be disrupted first.
And we've seen the response in the US is to take a far more partnership-based approach with some of the fintechs, some of the established Visa and MasterCard payment gateways, and to try and incorporate their solutions, their technology, onto and the scaffolding provided by the bank. Otherwise, it is going to be the likes of Facebook and through WhatsApp that are going to come and eat the bank's lunch. Speaking of eating your lunch and having a look at how you might want to slice it differently, Unilever has announced its strategic review and it's now extending to its smaller health and beauty brands. It's going to take up to a year and it could result in disposals of some of its slower growth brands in the segment. Really much in line with the messages that we've been getting from CEO Alan Jope's focus on growth. And I'm sure the market will be welcoming this news from Unilever. For some time, activist investors have been unimpressed with the FMCG giant.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I think investors are putting a lot of pressure on management in these big, we call them FMCGs, as fast-moving consumer good companies. A similar story is taking place at Nestle, where the underlying brand value is identified, but shareholders believe not sufficiently monetized, because these are just huge, you know, behemoths that that are very slow, you know, to adapt and to be agile to changing market conditions. You know, the investment case for Unilever has been very much in a value-based one for a long time. The dividend yields are around 3%, which, you know, in hard currency terms is pretty solid. But I think the area that was identified as being quite weak is that their organic sales growth, in other words, their ability to, you know, ramp up volume and to price effectively, you know, has been a little bit of a disappointment. And I think what they need to do now and what they're focusing on doing is changing, you know, their portfolio and identifying brands that they can, you know, ramp up that organic sales volumes, you know, because that's where they get the biggest value out of their management time.
Just lastly, Richard, I want to touch on the Discovery trading statement. It was out yesterday, but we didn't have time to get to it with Liston Mankies. The stock was down another 4% today. It was down massively yesterday, a big miss on Vitality Life's earnings. So given that loss, I think the main concerns really are around capital allocation and the focus on the UK business. There has been some concern around that for a while now, and those concerns are likely to intensify. What do you make of Discovery at these levels?
Yes, Michael, the jury is definitely out on Discovery on their capital allocation, the UK life business, which is where I think most analysts were expecting that business to break even in the current period, and they're guiding that it will make a loss. So certainly there's a negative mark against their capital allocation in terms of those markets. I think in looking at some of the other international markets, I mean, their big platform is Vitality, and I think that's where their success will potentially be. Certainly, I'm a believer in the Vitality chassis and the Vitality product, and they've taken that with a whole lot of, they've also used a partnership approach. They've partnered with AIA in Asia. They've got North American partners through Manulife and John Hancock. They've got Generali in Europe. So they've really got some good partners in those markets. But now they need to start monetizing. It's still early days for the platform, the Vitality platform in those markets, and for the user uptake. But certainly I think the trends there are looking good. Ping An in China, they've had some very good numbers, very good growth numbers out of that business, where they have a JV with Ping An Health there. But certainly over the next 3 to 5 years, I think the profitability in those offshore operations needs to ramp up significantly to justify the amount of capital that's been invested in those markets. Yeah. Also in South Africa, they obviously guiding that the bank, which was only launched in the middle of last year, obviously a lot of setup costs and marketing costs and people costs to get that bank in place and the infrastructure in place and to get the product up and running, with a lag in terms of when customers join. So probably the worst 6 months that the bank will show, and it should start to get better from this point, but probably going to be loss-making for the next few years. And in terms of getting to a reasonable return on capital based on around 5 billion rand that they've invested in the bank, that's probably at least 5 years away. So yeah, these things do take time. It's a very entrepreneurial company. I mean, if you think where they came from 25 years ago, where they hardly had a customer, and now one of the biggest life assurers and healthcare administrators in South Africa. I think you need patience with some of these entrepreneurial businesses. And I think ultimately, in a lot of areas, they will deliver the goods, and especially, I think, the Vitality business internationally.
Psalm 23:4, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. They call it the valley of death before you show that profitability. I think that's what investors and shareholders might have to be doing now. Richard Hassan, Fund Manager at Electus Fund Managers, and Nessa Nair, Portfolio Manager at Sasfin Wealth, with your view from the market.